Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and candidates on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be taking time to speak with Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby, economist Diane Lim. Lim will be joining us for the next installation of our newest recurring segment, The Economist Mom, and we'll also be joined by New Hampshire State Director Tyler Sweeney. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. Washington's 2019 fiscal year began October 1st. Fortunately, Congress avoided at least a partial government shutdown, but will have to revisit the issue. The president has signed 5 of the 12 annual appropriations bills for fiscal year 2019, which we're now in, along with a continuing resolution that will keep funding going for the rest of the government until December 7th. That's a big improvement over recent years, with the process largely helped by last year's increases in discretionary spending caps. But even that success does not signal that policymakers are beginning to get a grip on federal budget deficits and the rising debt. In fact, the fiscal year 2018 budget deficit grew from $664 billion the year before to $782 billion. The Congressional Budget Office projects this year's deficit will reach nearly $1 trillion. Lawmakers are preparing for what could be a contentious spending showdown leading up to the new December deadline when the existing continuing resolution expires. The biggest potential sticking point is the Homeland Security bill, where there is debate over including funding for President Trump's proposed border wall. Housing aid, which is separate from FEMA funds for disaster relief, may soon be on the way for victims of Hurricane Florence. $1.7 billion in hurricane relief passed through the Senate as a part of the Federal Aviation Administration reauthorization bill. Having already passed the House, it now awaits the president's signature. North Carolina, which suffered the bulk of the damage during Florence, would get $1.14 billion, while South Carolina would get $540 million to help provide housing aid to families made homeless in natural disasters, specifically Hurricane Florence. The government is about to overhaul and turbocharge its financing of infrastructure projects in the developing world. Also part of the FAA reauthorization bill, this new measure would consolidate several development finance institutions into a new U.S. International Development Finance Corporation with a total capitalization of $60 billion. This is double the limit of its predecessor, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation. The bill's passage has been one of the few instances of bipartisan foreign policy initiatives backed by the Trump administration. Up next, economist Diane Lim will join me and Concord's executive director, Bob Bixby, for the next installation of our newest segment, The Economist Mom. We'll be breaking down how financing the debt works. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by economist Diane Lim and Concord's executive director, Bob Bixby. Diane is currently a principal at the District Economics Group. She also teaches courses in behavioral economics and tax policy at George Washington University in Georgetown. She was also the Concord Coalition's chief economist from 2008 to 2012, and she also has quite a resume, having been with organizations like the CBO, Brookings Institute, Pew Charitable Trusts, the House Ways and Means Committee, and the Budget Committee. She's also now a regular contributor in our newest segment, The Economist Mom. Bob, of course, is a well-known voice on the show and fiscal policy expert. Happy to have you both on the show once more. Excited to continue this new segment, Diane.
Thanks, Chase. It's great to be here again.
So today we're talking about how financing the debt works, and we're going to break that down and even go so far as to relate it to how it impacts the everyday American. And maybe before we get into too much of the nitty-gritty, you can start with explaining the difference between the national debt and the annual deficit, and then maybe give a quick summary on how the deficit even works.
Okay, well, let's first take a step back even further than that and make sure the audience understands that we're talking today about the government debt. And of course, the overall debt in the economy is not just what government borrows, but what the private sector borrows as well. So today we're going to talk about what the government, in particular the federal government, borrows to pay its bills, ongoing bills. So at a basic level, the government borrows for the same reason that individuals borrow when they want to consume or spend more than their current income allows. So that's when the government has available the capacity to put out treasury debt that individuals and other governments or any other organization can actually invest in, and that's how they get more cash. So when we talk about the deficit, the government deficit is just the difference between annual spending and the government's annual income or revenues. So that's a flow measure. It's how much is the government spending beyond its income in the current year. And that amount of borrowing is added to an accumulated stock measure that's called the debt. So the debt is a stock measure of accumulated past deficits and the cost of financing those deficits as well. Well, actually, every year, part of what the government spends beyond its income includes the cost of servicing past accumulated debt. Just like if an ordinary household was borrowing and what you end up having to carry into the next period in terms of your debt is your accumulated past debt and the interest that you're paying back on it or that you're accumulating in that current year plus any new amount you're borrowing. So every year, the government has been in, ever since the late 1990s, at the end of the Clinton administration, the government's been running deficits each year, not surpluses. So each year we've been adding to the accumulated federal debt. So that's the difference between deficit and debt. Then there are other debt measures. There's two different debt measures that often get cited, used differently by out in the media. There's something called gross debt, which is the entire amount of accumulated deficits over income or borrowing, I should say spending over income that the federal government has done in all of its programs, all of its government programs over time. The gross debt, though, is larger than the concept called debt held by the public, which is like a net debt concept, which is a concept that economists like to focus on because it's more literally what the government owes to individual investors who hold treasury debt rather than what the government owes to itself, which is part of what gross debt includes, is debt that one part of government owes to the Social Security and Medicare trust funds because Medicare and Social Security ran surpluses in the past, and there was a difference between gross borrowing and net borrowing.
And Diane, can you explain a little bit the nominal difference between our gross debt and publicly held debt? I know our gross debt is about $21.6 trillion. Is there a significant difference in how much our publicly held debt is? And also, I wanted you to clarify one thing. You mentioned treasury debt. One question I often get at events for the Concord Coalition is, what is our actual debt? So can you explain maybe what the financial vehicles are that are being purchased to meet our debt needs?
So first of all, the debt held by the public is now something on the order of $15 trillion, and you mentioned the total gross debt is on more like $21 trillion. So it's a significant difference. The debt held by the public is what we actually have to pay interest on because the government has to include that as a cost that is paid. It's called net interest, it becomes part of government spending each year. So the debt held by the public is around $15 trillion. The interest costs on that debt are on the order of $300 to $400 billion a year right now, but they're projected to grow to almost $1 trillion a year by the end of the 10-year budget window. So that is increasing as a share of both government spending and as a share of the economy. What that interest, who is receiving those net interest payments? Well, there anyone who decides to buy treasury bonds as part of their investment portfolio. All kinds of people buy treasury bonds. Individuals hold treasuries as a very, it's considered a very safe form of investment, the world's safest investment. It's the reason why a lot of global interest rates are tied to the whatever is being paid for treasury on treasury debt. Companies hold treasury assets as part of their investment portfolios. And even foreign governments hold treasury debt as part of their investments, their public investments. So that's why the U.S. fiscal situation has become such an important part of the global economy, because essentially the world's financial markets really rely on treasury assets, treasury debt, and what turns out to be the investors' assets that they hold as a safe, relatively low-yielding but safe, stable asset to hold, investment to hold.
And Diane, you mentioned that among the various holders of government debt are foreign nations. And I know we get that comment a lot. And when you and I were out doing a fiscal wake-up tour, I know we used to get that question a lot, is how much of our debt is owned by foreign investors?
Yeah, and it's fairly significant. It's, you know, on the order of 40 to 50% of the current stock of U.S. federal debt is essentially owed to foreign individuals or foreign governments. It's significant.
What's the effect of that?
The economic implication of that is in the days when the U.S. had a significant public debt, yet didn't have much foreign holding of debt. So, for example, at the end of World War II, when we had very high debt as a share of GDP, the vast, vast majority of that debt, right over 90-some percent, was held by Americans. And so the argument has been made periodically when you think about the economic long-term economic consequences of a government, the U.S. government running debt. The concern is that over the long term, this is not free money. It has to be paid back. It has to be paid back to the investors who are holding treasury assets. Well, back in the day when it was just other Americans holding treasury assets, that didn't seem like such a bad thing. Like, yes, it represents a higher cost. Something has to come out of pockets of some Americans in the form of higher taxes or lower services. So that'll come out of the pockets of some Americans, but it'll go into the pockets of other Americans because other Americans profit from or benefit from, get income from the flow of interest payments that the federal government makes on treasury debt. So it's sort of like, you know, you have to follow the money where it goes. So what's a little bit more concerning from a long-term sort of U.S. economic growth, strength of the U.S. economy in the global economy perspective is the fact that if you have more and more foreign individuals and governments holding U.S. Treasury debt, then it means that we can't sort of comfort ourselves, Americans can't comfort ourselves by saying, oh, don't worry, like some of what we pay back in the future, some of what our kids pay back in the form of higher taxes will go to other kids of ours who
The benefit of that borrowing, some of it is flowing abroad.
And that's different from like at the end of World War II, where, first of all, at the end of World War II, we kind of quickly moved from very high deficits back into more manageable deficits. So we quickly tried to pay down a lot of that government borrowing. And it was going back to Americans who had invested in treasuries almost in a sense, out of a sense of patriotism, right? So they were war bonds. It's a very different dynamic these days because no one seems to invest in treasury debt for patriotism. It seems to be it's a safe investment, and people are worrying that it's not as safe as it used to be. And at the same time, it's more of a global safe investment rather than a safe, patriotic thing to invest in for Americans.
And it seems more of a like an economic argument that you've made, whereas a lot of people, I think, worry about too much of the foreign debt being held as a national security issue, as a, you know, other countries having leverage over the United States. And that may be something of an issue, too, although if they hold a lot of our debt and then did something to endanger our debt, that'd be in some ways endangering themselves.
Right. Well, that's right.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking with Concord's executive director, Bob Bixby, and economist Diane Lim for our newest segment, The Economist Mom. We're breaking down how our national debt is financed, how it impacts individuals as well as the economy. And I wanted to piggyback off of what we've been talking about interest rates. And you mentioned a dollar figure earlier in this segment about, you know, how much we're paying towards interest. But are there any other costs to having such a high level of debt, having such a high level of interest payments within the federal budget? How does all of this impact our economic growth?
You know, I think the costs of deficits and the government borrowing are more than just the dollar cost of the share of GDP. It's what that commitment or that financial obligation of the federal government crowds out in terms of what they might have spent funds on otherwise. So it is a significant fraction of the federal government's budget. It's a significant fraction of our economy right now. If you look at CBO's latest outlook report and you kind of look at how they break down major categories of revenue and spending, you quickly notice that the net interest the federal government pays on the debt is the single fastest growing category of spending in the federal budget right now. And economists usually view that category of spending as the most unfortunate category of spending because it doesn't go toward anything that is a public good. It literally goes to whoever's holding treasury debt rather than to the public. So it is a net cost to society. It does not translate into a public benefit, unlike other forms of government spending. And so that has been, you know, around 1.5% of GDP recently, but it's projected to grow to more than 3% of GDP. So in other words, it is more than doubling over just the 10-year window based on current law, by the way.
And if you put that in perspective, it's growing at a rate that very soon, within the next couple of years, interest would be a bigger cost to the federal government than defense. Think about that. More interest on the debt than we spend on the entire national defense. Or if you want to flip that around, interest on the debt would cost more than the entire discretionary budget, non-defense discretionary budget, those annual appropriations bills. So it's In dollar terms, it's really a very significant and growing part of the budget. I wanted to ask or at least bring up another part of that borrowing, too, because borrowing itself isn't a bad thing. Debt in itself isn't necessarily a bad thing. It seems to me a distinction between what you're borrowing for. So if you're borrowing for investment purposes, that's one thing. If you're borrowing to finance current consumption, that's quite another. And could you talk a little bit about that in terms of the federal budget?
Yeah, well, I think that economists worry about the deficit situation, the fiscal outlook, because it seems economically unsustainable. And what we mean by that is that we're borrowing at a rate at which our economy is unable to keep up with the growth in the debt. So it's sort of like a household borrowing in anticipation that their income will be higher in the future so that they'll be able to, you know, handle that debt burden. Their credit card bill is growing, but so is their income. So everything will be okay. Well, it sort of depends on what you're spending, that what you're putting on your credit card. Because if you're using that debt to finance things that grow your economic capacity in the future, that is a winning, that's that's a good, successful kind of strategy, right? It's like
maybe
it's making,
education or buying a house or something that's going
exactly.
to appreciate.
Exactly. I wouldn't so much say buying a house,
maybe.
But after
appreciating value something.
But yes, investments, things that you think will grow in value over time. Yes. So I like to think that the amount of money I spend on my kids' college education will pay off. And it's worth even borrowing to finance college education because it makes possible the accumulation of human capital that otherwise would not be possible. And so similarly with government, debt is a good thing if it makes possible very worthwhile investments that would not be possible otherwise without borrowing, because investments are often expensive. But that's okay. You want to be able to take advantage of a good opportunity for economic growth in the future to build our kind of supply side of our economy. And so the fact that government can borrow so easily is a good thing because it means that the government can invest in the future. The trouble is that a lot of things government may borrow money for are things that are just one-off events that are not going toward permanent investments or long-term investments. They're just the equivalent of the family putting a vacation on its credit card. So that's where you get into trouble, is where you're building up debt that you will have to keep paying back in the future. And it's accumulating and interest is compounding. But the things you put on your credit card, the things that you borrowed for, are not things that add to your economic capacity going forward. So that's when you get an unsustainable situation where your debt and your debt burden and what you have to pay every year keeps growing and growing as a share of your income, and you haven't done enough to make sure that what you're borrowing for is growing your income.
Diane, I wanted to jump in here. I wanted to ask, can paying interest on the debt, we mentioned how having large growing deficits and a large growing interest payment, can that have any kind of positive economic impact if, say, you have a larger share of domestic holders of the debt? And maybe a follow-up question that I have there is, who or what dictates the interest rate that we're paying or even how much we're paying in interest on an annual basis?
Okay, well, so there are two sides of the transaction in terms of when the government pays interest on the debt, right? There are people that are receivers of those interest payments who are holders of Treasury assets. So that's a good thing. When interest payments go up, it's saying that, well, if you're an investor and you hold Treasury assets, then that's a healthy part of your portfolio. Maybe that part of your investment portfolio is growing. Maybe you're putting even more into Treasury debt because it's paying off better. And it's a stable form of income. On the other side are the people who are paying the interest, which is not just the government, but it's all of us that comes out. You know, every part of us benefits from government spending or tax cuts. And so it's coming out of the public part of our national spending. And so it's going to raise costs and crowd out different forms of government spending. And that's going to be a cost to the rest of us who don't hold Treasury debt. What determines the interest rate, what determines sort of the interest payments on the debt, it's a combination of, if you think about it, it depends on, just like when you pay interest, make interest payments on credit card bills, it's a combination of how much you borrowed. It's a byproduct. It depends on how much you borrowed, your principal, the stock of debt that you've accumulated, times the interest rate on that debt. And so for years, we had been experiencing unusually low interest rates, despite the fact that deficits and debt as a share of GDP in our economy were growing. And that was because what determines the interest rate, which is the price of borrowing, is supply and demand. How many investors are out there willing to provide capital to the U.S. government to borrow, and how much demand does the U.S. government have to borrow? And so in previous years, over the past two decades, essentially, we had run from surpluses at the end of the Clinton administration to, we had turned from surpluses to deficits within a couple years in the early part of the Bush administration. And yet, despite that huge turnaround in the level of borrowing the federal government was doing, we didn't see any increase or a notable increase in interest rates on the debt. We saw a tremendous increase in the stock of debt. We didn't see a dramatic increase in total interest payments on the federal debt because the interest rates were staying really low. And that was going on because of a combination of the fact that we got a lot more interest in foreign governments to hold treasury debt. So there's a big increase in capital that was coming from other countries into the U.S. And that was helpful because it made up for the fact that the private sector in the U.S. was not saving very much. So we weren't going to be able to draw much capital from American investors. We had to rely a lot more on foreigners for our capital. And then combined with accommodative monetary policy, like the Fed kept doing what it needed to do to keep interest rates low throughout the period where the federal budget outlook was looking like it should theoretically have driven up interest rates. And instead, interest rates stayed fairly low because we had supply coming in from abroad. We had supply of capital coming in from our monetary authority. So that combination kept interest rates low. That was a benefit to the U.S. government in that it held borrowing costs and net interest payments down for the U.S. government. But economically, I've always seen it as a negative, a downside of that, of low interest rates, is that there was no price signal being sent to American politicians or private sector people about the economically unsustainable effects of borrowing, because it looked like it was cheap. And it looked like it was continuing to stay cheap. And so a lot of Americans, I think, and a lot of policymakers kind of were shrugging their shoulders saying, this record-setting deficit, this is not so bad because, look, at interest rates are still so low. How bad can it be?
Like a teaser rate.
Yes.
So, Diane, let's talk about some of those sort of real costs to everyday Americans. We're running out of time, so this will be our last question, unfortunately. And I want to bring it full circle to the purpose of The Economist, Mom, and let's make it real to our listeners. And we've mentioned credit card bills and public costs in terms of having interest on the debt and how what share it is of the economy and our federal budget. Bring it down to this granular level. You know, can higher interest rates, can a higher cost of interest impact everyday Americans, and how?
So we're just starting to see the 10-year Treasury rate come up. We haven't seen that in a long time. And I mentioned before that Treasury debt is like the world's safest investment, and a lot of global interest rates are private sector interest rates are tied to whatever is the Treasury interest rate. And so the fact that Treasury interest rates are starting to come up means it's inevitable that all interest rates in our entire economy are going to start to come up, which means mortgage interest rates are going to come up. Interest rates on student loan debt are going to come up. Interest rates on any kind of consumer borrowing that people do, on their credit cards, to buy a car, all those types of interest that affect everyday households. We used to talk about this at the during the Clinton administration, because during the Clinton administration, we would see the connection between a rise in deficits and debt and a rise in market interest rates. We haven't really seen that correlation since the Clinton administration. We didn't really see it in any noticeable way during the Bush administration, even when we went from surpluses to record deficits. Well, we didn't see it when the Obama administration, had to respond to the Great Recession and the credit crisis. We just have not seen this connection, this symptom of borrowing in a long time. The price signal is a plus, because once interest rates start coming up, that means the cost of borrowing has come up in an obvious way, and that reduces demand for borrowing. And so that's a natural economic break. It's like the invisible hand working in terms of borrowing in the economy. It's a natural economic break to reverse or tamp down what is an unsustainable rate of borrowing.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Bob Bixby, and Diane Lim during our new recurring segment, The Economist Mom. Thank you both for joining the show. Looking forward to our next segment with you, Diane, in a couple weeks.
Thanks.
Up next, Concord's New Hampshire State Director Tyler Sweeney will join me to discuss his recent experiences in the field. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Concord's New Hampshire State Director, Tyler Sweeney. Tyler has been on the show before, but it's been a while, so we're happy to have him back. He's a New Hampshire native, a state, local, and national political campaign veteran, and he now works for the Concord Coalition, facilitating our grassroots efforts here in New Hampshire. Welcome back, Tyler.
Thanks for having me, Chase.
Always a pleasure to have you on the show. I wanted to have you on today specifically to talk about some of your recent grassroots events and some of the events you have upcoming, not just to talk about your experiences there, but to maybe discuss how potentially easy it could be for concerned citizens to get more involved with the Concord Coalition throughout the state. So maybe give us a quick summary of a couple of your recent Concord Coalition events and maybe a description of what you have coming down the line.
Okay. Well, I have been traveling the state doing speeches at local civic organizations as well as some local party committees. Basically, we run through some charts that the Concord Coalition puts out that are based on CBO numbers to hammer home the difficulties that our country is looking at further down the line when it comes to our fiscal outlook.
So you mentioned that your presentation involves some charts that we put out there based off of the Congressional Budget Office. Can you maybe give a little more detail of what that presentation entails, how long it is, and whether you open it up for questions at the end? What's the experience like for both you as the presenter and maybe even someone sitting there listening to you drone on like they're listening to us right now?
Oh, don't pretend it was going to be a painful thing for them to listen to me.
I don't pretend.
Oh, that hurts me. Anyway, it's a 20-minute speech. I usually have about 5 minutes built into the end for question and answers. It really is pretty easy to slide it into just about any meeting or setup. And we usually get a pretty good response from people that are listening.
Why do these events? Why are you even going out and speaking to civic organizations or political party meetings? What's the point from your perspective? What are you trying to achieve here?
Well, the Concord Coalition's main goal is education. It's not something that you're going to walk away with a full understanding from a 20-minute conversation. However, we hope to help you get there. And the best way that citizens can continue to work with us is by continuing to be involved in paying attention to these issues. And then as citizens engage candidates, both in the upcoming elections and in 2020, we hope that they're able to take the information that we're giving them and apply it to the things that they care about and their conversations with candidates, and hopefully impress upon candidates that a responsible fiscal future is just as important as any partisan goal.
It can be a dense topic, one that can be a little hard to get direct answers from candidates as they're out there campaigning, because certainly some of these issues can be tricky to deal with and even to advocate on reform. And one other piece of information I always like to remind our listeners, and when we're doing events like this, is we're not out there as an organization advocating for a specific platform or endorsing candidates. We're simply trying to be a nonpartisan provider of the facts that are occurring, like what the trends are in the federal budget and how we got there and perhaps how policy might be able to change things. So bringing this back to your experience in the state thus far, what's been your favorite event that you've worked on specifically, and why?
My favorite event actually results from what happened following the event and not exactly what happened at the event. I had a speech at a local Rotary Club, and about 2 hours after I left there, I got an email from a gentleman that had attended, and he requested to have access to the charts that I had used. And naturally,
which, by the way, are available on our website.
Which are available on the website. Then I got an email from him. Can I share this with some friends? Next thing I know, I've got 4, 5, 6 people trying to get access to the charts, and they're sharing it with their friends. And it was this little ripple effect from this one speech where it showed just how much people actually care about this and are willing to talk with their friends and family about it. And I really appreciated seeing that kind of energy from people from a 20-minute conversation.
Yeah, some of the information we put out there isn't widely known or perhaps not beyond the maybe political rhetoric that you hear during a campaign or from a particular party on either side of the aisle. So what's been your least liked experience so far? Maybe you had a particularly large flub during a presentation or a hostile crowd that was asking tough questions. What's been your least favorite experience so far?
I think you know exactly which experience that was, because you were in the back of the room enjoying my suffering, and that was the very first speech I ever gave. So I was justifiably nervous. And it went.
Was that largely because I was in the room?
It was largely because you're in the room, and the speech didn't go as smoothly and as eloquently as it should have. And I definitely wasn't as precise as I should have been. And then follow-up questions were pretty strenuous.
I think it's a great example of it can only go up from here. And it's a good example of what it could be, what it might be like for a volunteer that's you know getting their bearings on these issues and wants to present to a particular civic organization as well. At the end of the day, it's a learning experience for all, and it can still be fun. So the good news is you went back and did another presentation. In fact, you've gotten some pretty high praise from organizations as you've been doing this. This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord's New Hampshire State Director, Tyler Sweeney. We're discussing his particular experiences in the field here in New Hampshire as he engages local organizations, particularly right now with our Chart Talk presentation, where he gives about a 20-minute presentation and takes 5 to 10 minutes of questions after that. My next question for you, Tyler, what have been sort of the standard status quo questions that you've been receiving from audiences on your last several events?
Well, a lot of the attention has turned to the tax cuts that passed earlier on in the year, and asking about what effect that's had on the projected deficits. Other than that, it tends to be basic understanding questions like what happened to the surpluses in Social Security? What can you explain Treasury bills to me? People have a general understanding of how budgets work. Everybody's got a budget personally, so it's kind of easy to transfer that over. It's just when we get into the nitty-gritties that they have more.
It's easy to grasp budgets. What a budget deficit is. It's like, hey, look, I'm spending more than I'm bringing in terms of revenue. I have a deficit.
Exactly.
And I agree. I think we get a lot of questions on the basics. What is the national debt? What level is it right now? What percentage of the economy? How does Social Security and Medicare fit in? What have been other more unique questions that have stood out to you?
Yeah, there was this one gentleman that actually asked why we don't sell off the highway system to pay for all of our outstanding debts. And, well, frankly, I didn't have an answer for him because I'd never heard that before.
Yeah, I don't think that proposal I've ever heard before either. Just to piggyback off of that, I think the most interesting question I've been asked is, what is the Concord Coalition going to do to increase the birth rate, basically? Because we talk a lot about how a lot of the challenges the federal budget faces and the nation faces are based on demographic shifts throughout our country. So that one stood out to me as, I hadn't really thought about that. But really have a direct answer other than I shifted quickly to something else.
Smart move.
So let's wrap this up here, Tyler. And you mentioned being asked, can people have access to charts? And I threw out that they're on the website. What are some of the things that people listening right now can do to either get more involved or get in touch with you to maybe have you come in and give a very rousing presentation on fiscal policy?
Yeah, it's very easy to get a hold of me. I am not hard to find via the Concord Coalition website. My email is tsweeney@concordcoalition.org. You can reach me there. If you have an organization that you want us to speak at, be that a local civic organization, a town committee for any of the parties, college group, whatever it is, feel free to reach out. We'd be happy to talk to anyone. We will work with just about anyone if it means spreading the meat.
That almost sounded desperate, Tyler.
Oh, come on.
Joking aside, we do a variety of presentations and events. One of my favorite setups is our interactive budget exercise. You and I worked with a couple college classes recently and had some great conversations there and saw some excellent results of the work they did. It's amazing how the everyday individual and taxpayer can look at the federal budget to come up with solutions, but that's a conversation for another day. Reach out to Tyler to get him in to give a presentation to your organization or even conduct an interactive budget exercise. I might even tag along as well. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Concord's New Hampshire State Director, Tyler Sweeney, talk about his experiences in the field for Concord's grassroots efforts. Thanks again, Tyler, for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, Chase.
We'll be back after these short messages for our final segment, Facing the Facts. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or piece of information I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. So, it's time to face this fact. Entitlement reform should reduce subsidies for those who don't need them. But let's clear the air first on one thing. The word entitlement is simply a budgetary reference to mandatory spending. It's not a derogatory or demeaning reference. As long as there is revenue coming in and the laws forming programs like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid exist, benefits have to be paid out. This might even be a touchy subject for those that feel entitlement to entitlements, no matter what, by virtue of having paid into the programs, which I completely understand. But I digress and will repeat. Entitlement reform should reduce subsidies for those who don't need them. Individuals with the least wealth or income potential are the most dependent on government programs for support. Thus, when policymakers talk about reforming entitlement programs, many observers are concerned about the potential impact on these vulnerable groups. The good news is that there are plenty of responsible ways to reduce costs without unduly burdening beneficiaries. Nearly all entitlement programs have conditions or formulas that take into account a beneficiary's income when determining the level of benefits or the amount of subsidy from the government. Many programs only provide benefits to individuals who have low incomes and/or low levels of wealth. These programs are known as, quote, means-tested. Those that are available to all, but with varying degrees of subsidy based on income, are considered, quote, universal entitlements. Social Security, the biggest program in the federal budget, is not means-tested. Beneficiaries with higher lifetime incomes receive larger monthly benefits, although beneficiaries with lower lifetime incomes have a greater proportion of their earnings replaced by Social Security when they retire. This makes it a universal entitlement program with income-related benefits. Social Security benefits could be reduced for those with high incomes during their working years or in retirement, providing large budgetary savings without impacting vulnerable beneficiaries. Several bipartisan commissions, including the Bipartisan Policy Center's Commission on Retirement Security and Personal Savings, proposed reductions in future benefits for higher income individuals while actually decreasing old age poverty. Medicare, the largest healthcare entitlement, is also a universal entitlement because eligibility does not depend upon income, and individuals receive the same package of healthcare benefits even if they have large amounts of assets or high incomes. Over the past 25 years, however, some modest income-related measures have been enacted to reduce the share of program costs subsidized by the government for well-off individuals. Most notably, there are slightly higher premiums for wealthier beneficiaries who sign up for Medicare Parts B and D. At the time these measures were enacted, many feared that charging higher premiums for some would undermine the program's foundation. But several years later, it is clear that they serve to strengthen Medicare by improving its finances without harming its beneficiaries. Given this success, policymakers should look for other ways to better target subsidy reductions. Medicare and Social Security are not only the largest programs in the federal budget, currently comprising about half of all non-interest spending, they are also the fastest growing. Means-tested programs, on the other hand, currently comprise just one-fifth of non-interest spending and are projected to grow more slowly. In fact, means-tested programs that provide benefits other than healthcare, such as food stamps, are projected to decrease relative to GDP or the economy over the next decade. The takeaway is clear. Policymakers can reduce federal entitlement spending without reducing subsidies for those who need them most. The same principle applies to revenue. Many of the largest, quote, entitlements in the tax code, such as the deduction for home mortgage interest and charitable giving, provide much larger benefits to those with the highest incomes.
the bipartisan Simpson-Bowles Fiscal Commission, and others have recommended eliminating or altering these deductions so that they don't provide subsidies to individuals who could afford and would likely engage in the subsidized behavior even without the tax subsidies. A sustainable fiscal policy requires hard choices and shared sacrifice. Policymakers can and should start this process by reducing subsidies for those who do not need them. You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.